Well, here's a sentence you don't often get to share. The man who used to run Parliament's finance oversight was, until recently, also the man who built the company that the Reserve Bank is investigating for allegedly moving 4 billion rand out of the country. We're going to get more details on that in just a moment. It's not a hypothetical issue, though. That's Mark Burke, Democratic Alliance MP. Until this week, the party's finance spokesman and regular participant here on BizNews TV. He's also, though, the founder, the actual founder of a fintech called Castello, which just lost a high court battle against the South African Reserve Bank and lost it badly. I've read the judgment, all 34 pages of it. Mark Burke isn't a bystander in this story. He's the founder of Castello, its CEO, until he entered Parliament in 2024. And he was its chairman until, by his own account, February this year. Somewhere in that timeline, he also became the DA's finance spokesperson, sitting on the Standing Committee on Finance and one of the exact structures meant to hold the Reserve Bank to account. And I want to be fair here, because Burke didn't arrive in Parliament as a passenger. He's been described already, although he's only been there a couple of years, as probably the smartest guy in Parliament. He's the man credited with out-arguing Treasury on last year's VAT increase, a rare genuine win for the opposition benches. He also co-authored a bill aimed at fixing governance failures at the PIC, another subject we've been talking about to him in some depth. In just under 2 years, he's built a reputation as one of the sharper minds in the chamber. And this isn't a nobody who's caught up in a scandal. It's someone with real credibility now facing a very direct question about how he built his fortune before politics. And that's the interview I want. Not a pile on, but not a pass either. Mark, good to have you. It's been a heck of a week for you. Did this all come out of the blue?
It's a good question, Alec. I think there's lead up to where we are, and perhaps the part to start with in answering the question is the amount of 4 billion rand which has been bandied about over the last few days. And I want to acknowledge that it is a massive quantum of money, and people are right to have an emotional response to that quantum of money. And if somebody was in fact siphoning off anywhere close to that money out of this country, that would be a moral and legal failure. And so to stop there and say, that's understandable, the reaction. Did it come out of the blue? The media storm, absolutely. And there's some context that we can speak to a bit later on what I think might be happening there. But the amount of money involved is not an amount that has been somehow siphoned out of the country and lost to the Republic forever. In fact, it's the exact opposite. If you think of any business acquiring goods abroad, they would, and now I'm wearing my Castello hat for a moment to try and answer the question because there's so much confusion. Any business looking to import something is doing so because they hope to attain a lower price for that purchase in a foreign place, and then to sell it for a higher price locally. And so value would leave in one form, being the currency payment for that good, and it would return in another form, being the good being sold here. And in this case, the good that was purchased was cryptocurrency, either Bitcoin or stablecoin. And it was without failure sold for a higher price on local regulated South African exchanges. Now you get to another point. The manner in which the quantums involved over many years were transferred is not with some operation that is entirely unregulated and sits outside of the law. Castello Pty, the organization in this dispute with Saab, has always had appetite for extensive licensing, and we can get to that a bit later too. And so the flow of this transaction for a client's benefit is that foreign currency is purchased from a local authorized dealer bank, that foreign currency is sent to an account for the client abroad. That client is then given the mandate for when the funds land for it to be transferred to an exchange so that they could purchase cryptocurrency at this lower price, return it, sell it for a slightly higher price, And this has varied over time, but definitely in 2025, the average was below 1%. Of course, if you do many transactions where you make slightly below 1%, that does add up to the client's benefit over time. And in so doing, when the cryptocurrency was returned to South Africa, there was a transfer of value back into the country, sold on a local exchange, and both the capital and the profit for the client's account here, so that the transaction could be repeated. All of that to say that this model does not work if the value that goes doesn't come back. And so the understanding of exchange control that says money can't leave, never to return, that's quite right in that if it was done in some surreptitious way that wasn't seen by the banks and the regulator, then that would be problematic under the current exchange control regime. But in this model, the value had to return without fail for the model to work at all. And in fact, if the value didn't return, the model would not work. So I want to be quite clear that the quantum that's being bandied about is large, but that amount of money is always returned to South Africa where it belongs every time, in much the same way that somebody purchasing a handbag or an iPhone abroad, hoping to make a profit when selling it here, would do the exact same transaction.
I guess the problem with all of this, Mark, is that it is exchange control regulations, which are, we're unusual in South Africa that we have them. And this is seen as a way around exchange control. This was seen as a bit of round tripping, benefiting from the regulations in the country. And I guess the judge was also pretty harsh in their judgment against Castella.
Well, no. Let's again interpret what is actually being disputed or what was disputed here, and then unpack perhaps the constituent bits. The Reserve Bank, when it launches an inquiry into matters such as this, has the ability to impose what's called a blocking order on an account. Now, the account in question at the authorized dealer bank, with clients' funds to their credit sitting in it, was blocked for 13 million rand at the end of 2025. And Castello approached the High Court on an urgent basis after trying to ascertain what the reasons were for imposing such a blocking order, to find relief and say that the usual concern that the money could be spirited away to another place while the investigation is ongoing simply doesn't apply here, in that the value has to return for the transaction to work. And in any event, the information is at the disposal of the regulator should they require it. So the only thing was this narrow procedural matter on whether the right under the circumstances was afforded to the Reserve Bank to maintain a blocking order. The court did not make any findings of guilt. It simply said this in the court's opinion, low bar, so-called reasonable grounds for suspicion to investigate existed, and therefore the Reserve Bank was entitled to impose and maintain a blocking order for the duration of the investigation. The purpose of the investigation then is to find that there might be or there might not have been a contravention of exchange control regulation. And only at the point where that investigation is concluded is the regulator then able to either impose what it deems to be an appropriate remedy, and if it wants to then forfeit a portion or all of those funds, it must apply to a court to do so at the end of that investigation. So it must be made quite clear that the dispute, and again, Castello took the Reserve Bank to court because it thought that the blocking order was imposed prematurely. The only finding was on whether that blocking order was maintained as the investigation continues.
So let's keep it really simple so everyone can understand. Cryptocurrency in South Africa trades at a premium to what it trades internationally. And like anything else, if it's too expensive in South Africa, you try and buy it offshore and you bring it back in. We have an open economy. 50% of our economy is trade, imports or exports. So what you were doing in this case was you, on behalf of clients, were buying Bitcoin and other cryptos overseas cheaper, bringing it back to South Africa, selling it in South Africa for slightly more, and arbitraging, in other words. Arbitrage is something I think that many people in the business community will understand. We've seen it on the JSE over many, many years on gold shares, for instance, that traded more expensive in London. But there's no more arbitraging on equities. But there is in crypto. So as I said before, the problem all comes in here is that you've got all these exchange control regulations. And that seems to be where the issue is here. Mr. Malherbe from the Reserve Bank's investigation felt that you were doing something untoward. What is the argument there? What's the issue that has actually landed Costello in such hot water, if not in fact, but at least in the media?
Well, the answer to that question from the other side of this equation would be, still wearing for the moment my Costello hat, that there were a number of indicators present for the regulator that combined constituted reasonable grounds for suspicion to proceed with an investigation. So the feeling that an investigator might have is not quite the same as saying, in their estimation, a relatively low bar has been attained to impose a blocking order and proceed with the investigation. But your question, I think, trying to simplify it a bit for people, I think your description of the flow is quite accurate. I think it helps people understand what's going on. The concern for the regulator, and there are multiple regulators involved here, is that the client might not have been appropriately party to every transaction, and I don't want to put words in their mouth. I'm trying to simplify it for your listeners. And therefore, suspicion arises on what's actually going on in this transaction. And they then list a number of the things that could lead to that reasonable grounds for suspicion. The difficulty you sit with is this, Alec, is if you want to engage in a business that sells foreign currency to South Africans, you go to the Reserve Bank and you say, can I please purchase foreign currency from a bank? And they say, go get yourself a financial services provider license from the FECA. And the products that they want you to have on there is usually a derivative product category and sometimes long and short-term deposits. And this is because of the way that the currency settles and how you can sometimes purchase currency in the future and have it settled at a later date. You can think, for example, of farmers and the like. And so you go knock on the door of the FECA and you say, I'd please like to apply for a license. And they say, well, put together the requisite team and service provider so you can prove to us that you will do this in a way that complies with regulations. So you get the key individuals and you get the compliance officers and you get the representatives and so on top of the operational staff and everything else that you might need. And you then submit a license application, which can be a number of licenses, but to try and simplify it for this purpose, it's either a category one intermediary license or a category two discretionary license. And then you can add whatever product categories you want, but we've now explained which ones you would need for the foreign exchange that you were interested in. And let's say you've put the team together and you apply, then hopefully if things go well and it's a solid application, 4 to 6 months later, you're armed with a license from the FSB. You then go back to the Reserve Bank and they say, well, deal with your authorized dealer. And you go to your authorized dealer and you submit an application to become a so-called treasury outsourcing company, which is an approval granted by the Reserve Bank. Costello Pty Limited did all of this. It obtained an FSB Category 1 and 2 license, allowing it to conduct on a discretionary mandate for clients transactions for their benefit under their name. It got the treasury outsourcing approval, and it also approached the Reserve Bank for its partner banks, including the bank involved here. Let's say a year later, you've got all of these licenses and commercial agreements in place with all the parties involved. You can then go to a client and say, I have partnered with X, Y, or Z bank, and there are certain tier two banks that have made a business out of this TOC model, and you can open accounts on their behalf, of course, with their mandate, with their agreement, with their explicit signature, with them asking you to do so after having marketed to them what the benefits are of having such an account. And then you can, when so required, you can purchase foreign currency, and then that sets off a whole bunch of reporting requirements. You need to fill in the forms. There's the bank itself or the business in partnership with the bank needs to prepare the information to go to the regulator, both programmatically and in a PDF form, if you will. And so goes the cycle for foreign currency. But you do have a challenge here in that the FSCA says you can have a discretionary mandate. And most folks asking Alan Gray or 91 to manage assets on their behalf do so on a discretionary basis. They say, do not try and tell me every time you need to purchase or sell a share. Once a year, we can perhaps check in. But until then, go ahead. You've got the discretion to make investments, and I want to see my investments grow. And that would, of course, make sense from a financial regulation perspective, if the checks and balances are in place. And so once one has this discretionary license, and the FSCA, of course, being the regulator, dealing with what's fair to the client and did they know about things and were they adequately informed and the like, the difficulty presents in that the Reserve Bank's position is, and this is clearly articulated when one applies, is that the client must remain principal to transactions. And that's fine. That would mean that the client must have an account in their name. So it cannot be that a company, in this case Castillo, goes ahead and it says, well, I'm going to book these transactions out of my account, and I'm going to somehow try and convince or confuse the bank into reporting that it's for a client's benefit. No, the money has to come from an account in the client's name. It has to go to a foreign currency account at that bank in the client's name and then be sent out from that foreign currency account. All of this existed. The discretionary mandate, the ability to open accounts, the client agreements that indicate that the client wanted that. And I must stop here and say that for Castillo, the business believes that it was industry leading. Clients had to watch a minute and a half explain a video that has to do with this whole trade that you've now described, that shows both in graphic and audio format what's going on. Clients were required to record their own selfie video saying they want to sign up. Clients had to sign a number of agreements, both with tick boxes and by appending their signature on screen. All of these things were in place. And then, of course, the reporting happened as it should have happened with the authorized dealer banks. And again, there it was industry leading. But the Reserve Bank doesn't have the ability per se to know all of this at the start of an inquiry. And the contention from Castillo at the time was that a blocking order of this magnitude would have an immobilizing effect on the business. And it would have a real effect for the small number of clients whose funds were in cycle for the trade and had now been stuck in limbo. And so approached the court to try and relieve the blocking order and offered to keep engaging and sharing all relevant information with the regulator, in this case being the Reserve Bank, satisfying it that Castillo acted on a discretionary mandate in compliance with this twin peak regulatory environment. And that's the technical distinction here, Alec. That is the going massively into the boring bits, where all of this, and what you will hopefully gather from that is it's a regulatory dispute. that's the matter at hand here. And of course, and I do think we should speak about this, Alec, over the last week, that has veered into the political sphere.
No, for sure. And I think it was important that we start off by having a look at the regulatory part. It's very clear to me that if you had anything to hide, you wouldn't be taking the Reserve Bank to the High Court. Clearly, you're not a fool, and that would be a really foolish thing. So we've got the regulations behind us. You have gone through all the hoops. You've jumped through all the hoops. You just wanted the Reserve Bank not to block your funds, which it's allowed to do, even if it has a vague suspicion. And that comes out very clearly in the judgment. You've also explained that the people who in whose name this was being done, they signed mandates, they even did selfies to say they understand exactly what it is. So
selfie videos.
That's a new thing. But that also addresses some of the things that that in particular the politicians have been laying out at you. So let's move to the other part, because this is the part that has been really juicy for everybody watching the story. The boring bits are not so interesting to them, but the politics is, because here you have a really smart guy who's taken on the ANC, stopped us from getting a 2% VAT increase, going hell for leather at the PRC where there are lots of crooked people. And look at him. You see, he's not clean himself. I've asked you this before, Bark. Politics is dirty. And I think we're seeing a lot of the muck coming out here. But how are you interpreting it?
No, exactly the same way. It's perhaps, again, worth trying to paint a bit of context on this regulatory dispute, which as we've now described, has existed for some time and has been covered by the media. When the urgent application was brought, there were finance publications such as MoneyWeb who wrote about this in February and March. But then all of a sudden, over the weekend, and by the way, after the DA announced a press conference on Friday about the PIC on Monday, over the weekend, there was this Business Day pursuit that had at its disposal not the judgment, which in its own right, as you say, the judgment came out strongly in favor of the Reserve Bank, and one would have wanted to report on that. But what it had at its disposal, Business Day, was the affidavit from the Reserve Bank. This is not a publicly available online document. One can, with some effort, go to a court and obtain that. But it stands to reason that if you had the affidavit, you'd also want to talk about the judgment. But they somehow seem to have the affidavit and knew that quoting from that verbatim, which is, of course, one side's version of what happened at the point that it happened in November of last year, with none of the context since then, that was then presented in the media as somehow being a... and as I say this, being presented in the media, I encourage journalists, as they've done this week, to do their job. I've always promised myself that when I get to this juncture, I will defend the right for the press to ask the hard question. So there's nothing wrong with that. But the reporting was debalanced. And in the case of Business Day on Monday, not talking about the other publications, which I would encourage to keep asking tough questions and beavers must beaver, the Business Day reporting was entirely unbalanced. They had sent a number of questions, which I had forwarded straight onto the Castello team, and I did not deem it appropriate for me to speak on behalf of the business. I still do so reluctantly to try and provide context. And the business answered those questions. For example, the chairman issue was relayed in a message, but not questioned. And the reality is, I'm not the chairman of the entity involved. I was for a time the chairman after I stepped down as the CEO, and even that ended in February. And then the reporting goes on to speculate on the reasons for that ending. But of course, you can imagine with a immobilizing blocking order on the business, and perhaps this is the juncture where I then take off that, but for a moment keeping it on for the business, the blocking order had the effect that the business went from near 70 people to less than 20. It had the effect that since January and February, a bunch of changes happened, and that also had an effect on the directorships. But there's now this other, and let's segue then, I'll try and put my DA hat on now. I had the ambition, and after engaging with people that whose counsel I value, I had the ambition from February onwards to become the federal finance chairperson for the DA, on top of being the DA's spokesperson on finance, meaning what other parties would call their treasurer general, was the role I was hoping to assume at our Congress in April. And so it made sense for a number of reasons, the changes at the business, my ambitions to step down as chairman. Anybody that knows anything about a business such as this would know that, when I was their CEO, I took responsibility for those decisions. But that ended when I was the CEO in 2024. The responsibility is perhaps a different matter, but it must be clear that I've not been day-to-day operationally involved in Castello since May of 2024. And this was at the time announced to a team of almost 40 people. So the record's very clear on what changes happened, and the reporting hasn't been accurate. And we then get to, why did it happen in this way on Monday? We'll get to there eventually as well. All the truth, I'm sure, will come out in the wash. But it must be said that the one-sided reporting set off a bit of a media storm. I still see balanced publications coming out with an actual description of events. That is where we are, and we'll deal with it as it comes.
Quite extraordinary, actually, in this day and age, that a mainstream publication would only quote from the one affidavit. I mean, clearly, if you're going to quote from the one side affidavit, you've got to have the other side. And if there's a judgment, why bother with the affidavits? It really does leave quite a few questions. But what about your decision to remove yourself from the finance cluster? What about the decision to no longer be the finance spokesman for the DA. Where does it leave you politically?
Yeah, I think that the DA has always held itself to a higher standard. And I want to stop here and just talk a bit about the sequence of events this week. We put out a statement on Tuesday and that sort of tried to outline the actual factual inaccuracies of reporting up to that point. And then did do a bit of a flip-flop as a party by Wednesday on me stepping down as the spokesperson of finance. I think I've always tried to recuse myself from matters that pertain to the Reserve Bank. The record of this is very clear. I let my chief whip know as soon as I became the spokesperson on finance that I have interest in the financial sector. And it wouldn't be appropriate for me to oversee the regulation of that sector, but that still left a lot of work in the finance portfolio, including the way our budgets get passed and how we think about fuel levies and so on. And I also recused myself to my colleagues. I recused myself to the Parliament Standing Committee of Finance Secretary on numerous occasions, and the record on this is quite clear. I went further than that, in that when industry bodies tried to engage with the party and emails would come through, I would immediately also recuse myself from that. And the record on that is quite clear. But we still got into the situation, and because there's a difference, a legal difference between adequate recusals and a public perception difference, it was the right decision earlier this week to step back from the finance cluster entirely, both the finance committee and the appropriations committee. And I think what we'll try and do in the process is make sure that my name, that Mark Burke, comes out of this when the investigation finally makes whatever findings it needs to make. That this was a bit of a witch hunt. It was all of a sudden that everybody wearing a hat looks like a witch. And the DA took proactive measures, responding to the public perception of what might be going on here. And it was the right decision.
But where does it leave you politically, Mark? If you were taking a lot of responsibility on the area that you know very well, are there other areas where you can make a contribution?
Absolutely. I remain on as the party's federal finance chairperson. I will continue to put my weight behind efforts of accountability. I will continue to advocate for the DA's cause. There's an operational machine humming towards the local government election in November. And the reality is, at least until then anyway, people are sort of half-focused on parliamentary work and are very focused on that election. I will throw my weight behind the DA and getting this election done and making sure that we deliver a bigger vote share than we ever have. And I'll continue trying to manage the party's finance as well. And there's still lots of oversight to do in Parliament while I step what we'll try and dance cluster for the time being.
But this whole media storm, it hasn't soured you from politics?
It's a good question, Alec. I think it sort of touches on the personal cost and the Churchill addressed a school, I think, in 1942, and he spoke about a hymn that talked about darker days. He said he doesn't want to call it darker days. He wants to call it sterner days. And I would say these are stern days for sure. I have no doubt, as I say, of what the cause is of the media storm, not the investigations. Those folk must continue to do their work without pressure or interference. But the media storm this week, I know the cause of that. I know that the ANC feels extremely threatened by somebody asking them tough questions about who the chairman was of the PIC, who the chairman is of the PIC, how much money has been looted, and how much do they still intend to loot to keep their operation running. In that sense, I'm undeterred. It would be to give in at exactly the juncture where they think that they're succeeding. And in fact, the opposite is true. The process will unfold, and I will stay the course for as long as I'm able to. And with the support of good people who care about the facts, and people who care about the facts would understand that this is a relatively complex matter that's fairly multifaceted, that must be allowed to run its course. But even its findings could at worst, based on past practice and industry standards, not be to the effect that the media has made it out, and this false equivalence that's being drawn between the DA and the ANC. And as far as I say, Business Day has tried to tie the DA to Castillo. So the answer to your question, Alec, is we'll keep marching on. We'll take the next hill and the one thereafter.
If I understand correctly, your position is this: you have a business, you started a business, you stepped down as CEO to go into politics, you chaired it for 2 more years, and then because you had ambitions to get more involved in politics, you stepped down as chairman. It was nothing to do with a court action and your stepping down as chairman. In other words, you weren't trying to disassociate yourself with the business. Your business, or the business that you started, actually took the Reserve Bank to court, not the other way around. And as a consequence of that, it felt that the Reserve Bank had acted too aggressively, it was too heavy-handed, and you wanted to release or get that reversed by the court. And then you believe that the ANC used the judgment in a way that it could embarrass you, and indeed the DA as a whole, but it used it in the way I suppose that politicians would. But despite all of that, you're undeterred. You are not going to step down. You are not going to leave the arena. You are going to continue asking tough questions of the ANC and pointing out where there are malfeasance and worse.
Alec, absolutely. The ANC will not succeed in this smear campaign despite their best efforts. They know, of course, that they've actually stolen public funds repeatedly. At no point in this whole conversation has the thought even come up with about public funds being in dispute. Putting on briefly again, my Castillo had to try and answer the first part of your question. There were a number of changes in the business in February necessitated by the blocking action. But as I say, the changes also overlapped with my own political aspirations. Keeping on the Castillo hat, there is absolutely nothing for the guys at Castillo to be embarrassed about, to stand back about, to feel that they ought to apologize. They have built world-class technology. They have served thousands of clients. They have generated tens of millions of returns for clients' benefit under their accounts on their allowances, and they can stand tall, knowing that they've consulted with leading law firms in the construction and the execution of this product throughout. I must add that Castillo, at the height of its operations, had 4 in-house counsel and a top 4 law firm engaging it. So the guys at Castillo can stand tall. The process must run its course. And switching back to the political hat, I have nothing to hide from anything that I've done leading up to my political career and thereafter. I've always tried to conduct myself with honor, with dignity, and with the best interests of South Africa at heart. And for as long as I'm able to continue doing that, I intend to do so.
Mark, just one final issue here. The Reserve Bank is sitting in a situation where it has exchange control, which people who come from a different view would say we shouldn't have anyway, but park that. In the exchange control, though, the relaxation of the requirements has been implemented over years, but the intention of that relaxation was that the R1 million a year that the, or R2 million now that the Reserve Bank gives to me to take offshore if I want to. There's no questions asked. I can do anything I want with that. And had Castillo restricted its arbitraging to that R2 million, it's unlikely in the logical mind that there would have been any issue here. But the R10 million investment allowance, that is from the Reserve Bank's perspective, meant to be put into equities, bonds, property, whatever it might be, offshore. Is that not something that, I see you shaking your head, is that not something that that you can see it from the perspective?
Keeping on the Castello hat, they are a big and important regulator in this country. Castello respects them, and I respect them in the oversight role. So they might have a different view that I'm not aware of, but it's not factually just on the issues at hand here. The Reserve Bank's contention in their papers is not that the utilization of the foreign investment allowance, in addition to the single discretionary allowance, the 1 million versus the 10 now, it's not that this 10 million utilization is a problem for them. In fact, and here you get into another, if you have twin peaks between the FSCA and the Reserve Bank, there's almost a third peak, which is SARS, in that the Reserve Bank has said the agent responsible for issuing the tax certificate so folks can trade on their foreign investment allowance, that is SARS. So don't approach the Reserve Bank to get a certificate so you can utilize the 10. Go to SARS and prove to them that you've got the resources and you want to do it. But within that application for a foreign investment allowance, one of the options you can indicate is crypto arbitrage. That's a tick box. You say that this money that I want to invest abroad is not for shares or equity, it's for crypto arbitrage. And it also allows you to tick a box that says the source of funds for this, and this wasn't the case for all clients at Castello, but it was the case for some clients at Castello, the source of funds can be a loan. And so then to turn around and say, no, but we as the Reserve Bank, I want to respect them. I don't want to infringe on their mandate at all. But I don't believe that their contention is that folks couldn't use the investment allowance to do crypto arbitrage. But if they did believe that, then I would assume that they would have to engage with SARS on why the executing agent is allowing it in that way. Getting into the very sort of complex, nuanced details of the transaction, it's hard to extrapolate from those sort of regulatory differences, misunderstandings, miscommunications, how people operating within the confines of what the regulations prescribe have somehow now missed a beat. And I must then add, without trying to indicate that anybody else should go through what Castello has been through, there are multiple firms in South Africa that offer this service along these lines. As you mentioned, many BizNews listeners would have benefited from this. And there's perhaps one more data point to add, that some industry participants that have led to this action from the Reserve Bank, folks that submitted anonymous complaints to the Reserve Bank competitors for Castello, did believe at some point in time that Castello might have been responsible for the compression of the margin based on its volumes. But the counterpoint to that reality, and now we get very technical, but maybe it's interesting for your audience, is Castello has effectively exited the market as of November, and the margin has only gone further down. So it would stand to reason that if Castello had exited, that the margin would have recovered or improved, but the opposite has happened. All very technical and complex regulatory matters, but definitely not at the level of what's now being an attempt to tie a heavily licensed business that at all times tried to be compliant to a political party and somehow infer that the political party or myself have acted in a way that was inappropriate.
And why did Castello exit the business in November?
Well, the short answer is out of an abundance of caution, but also operationally, because a main account responsible for its flow had been effectively blocked. So you sit with two problems as a business. You say, the regulator is clearly upset. We don't want to antagonize them. That's never been our intention. We've collaboratively worked with all regulators as a business, the guys would say, over many years. And perhaps the most important, or one of the most important ones, is the Reserve Bank. Please don't do anything to further antagonize them out of an abundance of caution. But operationally also, it would become very difficult to try and find a different bank so that the funds could be moved in and out after sale, and so out from the one bank back into the accounts, it becomes operationally quite complex. Castello made the decision at that point not to continue until the matter had been settled. And as I said, it has had a devastating effect on the business, staff-wise, client-wise, and in many other ways. So, of course, Castello hopes that the matter will be resolved in the right way.
And that point that came out in the judgment about Access Bank thinking about cutting your account or cutting Castello's account anyway, what was that about?
That was not the view of the leadership of Access Bank. We have many meetings and many correspondences indicating that they had appetite and that Castello as a business was one of their growth partners as this multinational bank expanding into South Africa. Just a bit of background for you, this used to be Bank of Athens. It was briefly Growbank, and then it was bought and is now Access Bank South Africa. Access Bank, I believe, operates, and I'm also careful not to incinerate the Castello Access Bank relationship by speaking too much about it, but it operates in South Africa as a startup bank, effectively. It's competing with the big boys, and it has to find growth partners, and thought and communicated on numerous occasions to Castello that this was their intention. We found out afterwards that there were two people in the compliance department, one of them since departed, an individual that fired a parting shot in the form of an unsigned, likely ChatGPT generated report to the Reserve Bank, had done massive damage. But the news and the court papers that even one or two people in the bank, and again, compliance people must do their work, and I think there are good compliance people across the banks, including at Access Bank. But the idea that the bank was thinking of offboarding Castello while communicating from the executive class to us how important we are to them was entirely incongruent. It was surprising, and Castello believes it was not a fair reflection of the actual bank's position, but in fact perhaps rather a sort of internal factional battle in which Castello might have become collateral damage. And the record states that this is a departed employee, one of the two people involved is a departed employee. And so, the truth will come out in the wash. We were never praised as Castello that there was a problem. We, of course, kept engaging with them on risk matters, on compliance matters, and dealt with those. But in as far as one has to jointly agree to compliance reports, if one has to do the adequate reporting jointly, the risk that we might imminently be offboarded, or the consideration even existed of an offboarding, the exact opposite was communicated to Castello.
It's quite extraordinary. If you were outside of politics and a business rival, say, spread this kind of information, the way that you've explained it to us now, it would trigger a lawsuit for sure. But because it's in politics and because you have parliamentary privilege in parliament, you don't have it outside of parliament, you have in parliament. It's almost like in the political sphere, people say what they like. They pick up stompies and make them into felt fires. Is there any recourse in this regard from your side, a legal recourse, or is that just going to make this whole thing even more time consuming?
I think the reality for Castello is that it needs to focus on its on the business's sustainability, and it needs to focus on engaging with the main issue at hand, which is the Saab inquiry. Of course, once that is completed, one has to consider what to do next, and if there were individuals that acted in a way that would indicate that they might have either been conflicted or dishonest, then one would have to consider that. But I think there's probably wisdom in keeping focus on the most important things for the time being, getting through the drift, as it were, and then and thereafter, seeing what needs to be done. And of course, one hopes that others would also look at the situation and say this is unacceptable, and perhaps they need to take action. be that commercial entities, be it whoever else, Castella has to focus on what's important to it right now, and as I need to focus on what's important for the DA right now, the reality is those things might come in the future, but we're not talking about that at the moment.
Dr. Mark Burke from the Democratic Alliance. I'm Alec Hogg from BizNews.com. Start your day a step ahead. BizNews Insider. It delivers the business stories that matter every morning straight to your inbox, sharp, fast, and free. Subscribe now.